Pierce, is that him? Well, tonight. Thirsty? Please, be my guest. I won't drink then. I think you're aware that this section we've been reading is also a portion of the Gleanings. It's quoted in the Gleanings. Passage 125 of the Gleanings. The whole question of the true seeker, his qualities, his attributes. The section, short section we read last week about the lamp of search, of earnest striving, that has to be kindled in the seeker's heart before he can escape from the darkness that surrounds him, before he can dissipate the mists of doubts that sometimes come to the soul. After the period of doubting God comes the period of doubting oneself. That's another stage, of course, in development. It's a better stage than doubting God, actually, I think. Then he announces on page 196 we were reading, he announces that the mystic herald, bearing the joyful tidings of the Spirit, he says, will shine forth from the city of God. And he describes this awakening of the heart and the soul and the spirit from the sleep of negligence, of heedlessness. And he says that the grace of the Holy and Everlasting Spirit, you can read for that Holy Spirit as well, that we understand from in Christian terms, confer such new life upon the seeker that he will find himself endowed with a new eye, a new ear, a new heart, and a new mind. For those of us that are dissatisfied with our present equipment, this sounds like a fine contractual arrangement we can enter into with the fulfillment of these. If that weren't enough, a few lines down below, he says that then you will see with the eye of God. That would help too, I'm sure, for us to understand things that we don't understand now. He will discover in all things the mysteries of divine revelation and the evidences of an everlasting manifestation. One of the tablets of Abdu'l-Bahá speaks about spiritual maturity. It says when the soul attains to spiritual maturity, it will progress in one day the same amount that before it progressed in 1 year. Interesting geometrical progression, isn't it? Of course, if you can see with the eye of God, you do take, I'm sure it must take in a lot of new information, new understanding. He talks in his tablets about abandoning the physical and concentration on material things until the spiritual powers possess the soul, until they take control of the soul and guide the soul. Then, through that spiritual power, one is able to carry out material affairs effectively, legitimately, and in conformity with God's good pleasure, rather than putting the material affairs first and having a little time left over for spiritual things. And not only is this mentioned in the Baha'i teachings, but in Christianity also, the saints, some of the famous saints, who by their writings reveal themselves to be saintly because of the quality of truth that they describe. They talk about how complicated material matters and material affairs can be carried out by very, very spiritual people because they're assisted by the Spirit to carry them out, so that they have that aid which enables them to remain, to sustain a spiritual attitude in everything they do, so that they don't have to turn off in order to mow the lawn and to deal with the other people in their department. because that's the only way to handle these things. They can do a whole thing with the right spirit and everything, still have the right attitude, and yet still accomplish things and still get to the goal that they set themselves. Now, if we have a whole society moving into that operation, expressive of the will of God and the way He wants things done and accomplished, that is, acting in such a way that you don't disturb the tranquility of the spirit, you don't disturb its awareness of the Sun of Truth shining on the fields of its soul, enjoying the sunshine of divine presence. You don't cloud it over with frustration and anger and upset and jealousy. It creates clouds that block its rays from shining on you. But you keep the sky clear and you retain this springtime freshness. Now, the new text that we start tonight on page 196, I don't know, British edition, do you have? What page is it in the British? 126. I swear by God. Yeah. I swear by God, were he that treadeth the path of guidance and seeketh to scale the heights of righteousness, to attain unto this glorious and supreme station. And then he gives a whole series of things. Besides what we've already read would happen to him, now he adds more on top of this. He says he would inhale at a distance of 1,000 leagues the fragrance of God, and would perceive the resplendent morn of a divine guidance rising above the dayspring of all things. Each and everything, however small, would be to him a revelation, leading him to his beloved, the object of his quest. So great shall be the discernment of this seeker that he will discriminate between truth and falsehood, even as he doth distinguish the sun from shadow. If in the uttermost corners of the east the sweet savors of God be wafted, he will assuredly recognize and inhale their fragrance, even though he be dwelling in the uttermost ends of the West. Let's start over again now. He that treadeth the path of guidance. This phrase of guidance and the path of guidance, of course, is the one that's set down in the tablets. All of the instructions of Baha'u'llah, all of the advices and admonitions and counsels of the Master, these constitute the path of divine guidance. He should seek to scale the heights of righteousness. Endeavor to improve ourselves. He talks about being able to perceive the fragrance of God here at 1,000 leagues, and also remember down below he mentions if in the uttermost corners of the east he perceives the sweet savors, same thing, fragrances of God. He'll assuredly recognize and inhale these. So now, how is this? There's some spiritual perception. There's some connection with the human spirit when it's in this condition and all other human spirit. It would be sensitive. I remember Riyakonam saying that the guardian was, he seemed to be like the heart of the spiritual heart of the Baha'i community, that when things were going wrong, they would reflect in him. He would feel them. He would be concerned and disturbed. And then later they would find out what was going on, or something was bothering. What was bothering? The same thing, the victories. He would feel the joy in the Baha'i world, so to speak. Maybe in some way that reflects what Baha'u'llah is trying to tell us here. That would be nice if we could participate in all of the teaching victories while we were working here in Haifa at our jobs, and we just suddenly filled with divine savors because something's happening on the other side of the planet. It's good. But I think we tap into it when we hear the messages like Tuesday morning, or when we see the cables that vibrate. Shoghi Effendi used to say, he'd read some cables, he'd say, superficial, no news at all. the table with the pilgrims. Then he'd have another one he'd read. He said, listen to this one. He'd read it. He said, spirit, pure spirit, read between the lines. Feel the power of the people. Feel the correctness of their attitude, their spirit. He'd talk about this. That's true. We get letters from people sometimes. You can feel in those letters that what's happening, what they're doing, you know, how they're exhilarated by the progress of their cause and their own upliftment through their activities. This line about discernment and the seeker discriminating between truth and falsehood. Abdu'l-Bahá, in one of the tablets where he describes the stages of progress of the human soul, which parallels what we see in the gleanings when Baha'u'lláh talks about the stages of the soul, such as concupiscence, irascibility, inspiration, divine good pleasure. These are some of these stages, traditional stages, that are found actually in references in the Quran. Baha'u'lláh says he doesn't wish to dwell on them, that every soul in this day who follows the behests and counsels of God will attain to all these stations. But then he also himself describes them in a couple places, in other tablets. He says, we have dealt with them, we've mentioned these subjects in other tablets. And Abdu'l-Bahá describes them in several places. And then the one where he talks about the stage of inspiration, concupiscence is the stage where the soul is abased, it's wed to its animal self, perfectly happy to carry on like a perfect brute, goes about its affairs, just in that spirit. Then the irascible soul, irascibility, concupiscence and irascibility, is the soul that can't be happy with its animal ways anymore. Something's happened to it. Somehow it's got this little touch of inspiration and been disturbed by religious feelings, and it just keeps accusing itself of why can't it break loose? Wants to now. It's attracted to something. It's the first stage of growth. It's attracted to the spiritual teachings, but doesn't seem to be doing anything about it. Constantly is accusing itself. Then Abdu'l-Bahá says the next stage is the stage of inspiration. Now the soul, at the first stage, he didn't know what was good and bad. Every time he did something, he'd find out after he did it whether it was good or bad. You know, well, that wasn't so good for me. Look at this, has dulled my spirit. This has dimmed my enthusiasm. Now, I thought I was just going to a movie, but when I came out, look at the state I'm in, you know. What's wrong with going to a movie? There's nothing wrong with going to a movie. But what happened to me going to this movie? Okay. Now the soul says, it comes to a stage where it's inspired. And Abdu'l-Bahá says, this inspiration, he doesn't describe it as inspiration like he's inspired with divine revelation or something of that sort. But he's inspired in his own understanding. He knows what's good and what's evil. He's inspired with good and evil. That is, he understands the difference. He can discern. And then he begins, because he can clearly see the difference, he begins to choose, or the soul begins to choose this path that's correct, those actions which are pleasing unto God. And so it's able to guide itself to choose the right over the wrong. Now, you remember some of the prayers. Abdu'l-Bahá says, I know not that which can pain or profit me. You know? The soul complains to God. It doesn't, can't even distinguish. But if we persevere, gradually we become aware of what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing. And the earnestness of the soul, the sensitivity of the soul, can tell us if we're moving towards light or if we're moving towards, if we're facing light or facing darkness. If we're moving towards, attracted and moving towards God, or if we're moving away from Him and towards the other end, which is self, ourselves. And that's a tremendous step which leads to the soul gaining certitude, assurance. And this is the next stage in this development. It's the assured soul. The soul that feels confirmed in the truth of revelation. Doubts are gone. And gradually from that, it matures and consolidates its activities, its services, and reaches towards stage of becoming pleasing to God, of perfection, and finally, he says, gets to the stage of the soul of the kingdom, he calls it. the soul of the kingdom, we all say, well, we'll see you in the kingdom, you know. Maybe we'll see you in the kingdom. But the stage of a soul of the kingdom is so exalted in the tablets that I'm not sure how I'm going to do or how anybody is going to do. I mean, we need to think about that very seriously. In one sense, the next world is the kingdom, but in another sense, the kingdom of God, the subjects of the kingdom of God, are those who submit to the will of the king. And the whole thing, our whole life here, is to learn how to voluntarily live under the rule of this divine spirit of the manifestation of God. And that's the big challenge, how to bring ourselves into conformity, how to gather in all of our other interests, so to speak, and center them and focus them, and then out of that be able to give fruit and bear a service and a usefulness that's like the spiritual maturity. One day worth of it is worth a year before. I think this applies also to the service of the friends that gain in spiritual qualities. Their acts, their different words, everything has a meaning. I always remember a story about a Baha'i, an older Baha'i, that when I became a Baha'i was in Los Angeles, but he was an invalid. He couldn't get out of the house, and we used to go and visit him and sit at his feet, really. He was a radiant old man. He'd been in Abdu'l Baha's presence, he'd been to the Holy Land, visited the guardian here. And if you sat long enough and quietly enough and listened to some of the old people talk, it was a little bit of old people talk, that would soon go away, and he would start realizing you were interested to hear. Then he'd become a mirror, and he would start reflecting marvelous spiritual truths, and he'd pull out, he said, now there's a tablet of the Master sent me, and he said, and he'd bring out any quote. He had them all there next to his chair that he was sitting in. And then Shoghi Effendi wrote him, and he'd get about 30 letters from Shoghi Effendi, and I don't know how many, half, 15, 16 tablets from the Master. He would weave these together, and what the Master said, and what the Master did, and what happened to him. I used to go there, I used to pray before I go there. I'd say, okay, now Abdu'l Baha, if you want to tell me something, I know that you can get this gentleman to tell me. And I would always feel like that whatever I had to hear, sometimes it wasn't what I wanted to hear, and it wasn't very pleasant, but I would get the point, you know, that this is what you have to hear now. Because this man had this quality of wanting to serve, wanting to lift the souls of others. And it's that, if we do that, if we get that quality, that's the kind of service, that's the kind of kindness that we can do to others, you know, encouraging them spiritually. And the more we do that, just as in teaching, it's a kind of form of teaching, when we do it with the right touch with each other, but of course teaching outside, helping others, there's a lot to this spiritual parenthood, spiritual mothers and spiritual fathers, and I think there's probably even spiritual aunts and uncles, because sometimes the mothers and fathers don't do the complete job, and you need to have the help of some other Baha'i teachers to focus you and give you some other ideas. And then your own children that you nurture, and you're so pleased when you see them grow spiritually and get up and go out and do things, and that connection that exists between the teacher and the one taught, that will be the source of bounties to both. The faith tells us in the world to come, it will be a source of great bounty to both. Whoever's quickened another soul and whoever's been quickened, that relationship will continue. We should pray for the people that have taught us the faith. And if you've been in a Baha'i family, you want to pray for your parents especially. We all pray for our parents, but especially if they've been the source of teaching us and giving us the revelation and reflecting in their daily lives their attitude towards Baha'u'llah in a way that inspires us and has given us a model that we can follow. So many of us come from backgrounds we don't have any model. And suddenly we see a couple of Baha'is that are doing a half good job, and we get so excited. We see the faith is alive. We see usually the teacher that's taught us, the person that's taught us the faith, has been confirmed by Baha'u'llah, or he's veiled us from their shortcomings for a time. I also see that in experience sometimes the person that teaches you the faith teaches you, and you see them almost, you know, like in the place of the prophet. They're just teaching, and you're so excited and you're so uplifted. And then a time comes when you have to be on your own, and it's as if Baha'u'llah lifts the veil a little bit, and you see this human being that's touched you the face, and kind of takes your breath away. And they have shortcomings? My goodness, you know. Test your faith for a minute. But then afterwards, that's a comfort to you, because you say, well, these same shortcomings are in me. Maybe I have a chance now to try to overcome these things and try to develop myself in such a way that I can be of the same kind of service, breathing life into the souls of others. He will likewise clearly distinguish all the signs of God, His wondrous utterances, His great works and mighty deeds. Now notice here you have a description of the signs of God. If you want to know what are the signs of God, they are His wondrous utterances, His great works, and His mighty deeds. They include other things as well, but this is a very poignant description of what these ayatollah, the signs of God, are. From the doings, words, and ways of men, even as the jeweler who knoweth the gem from the stone, or the man who distinguisheth the spring from autumn and heat from cold. When the channel of the human soul is cleansed of all worldly and impeding attachments, it will unfailingly perceive the breath of the Beloved across immeasurable distances, and will, led by its perfume, attain and enter the city of certitude. Now, of course, this is particularly applicable, imagine, in the immediate case of the Bab's uncle, where Baha'u'llah is promising him that this perfume of the new revelation will attract the soul and confirm the soul. That if the soul is cleansed, it will be attracted to this breath. It will guide him to the Word of God, the city of certitude. Therein, in this city, in the Word of God, he will discern the wonders of his ancient wisdom and will perceive all the hidden teachings from the rustling leaves of the tree which flourisheth in that city. Audubon talks about when you say here, you see here, he says the channel of the human soul is cleansed of all worldly and impeding attachments. He also talks about it as an instrument, that the human soul is an instrument, like a channel of a woodwind instrument, for example. It's cleansed, it may attract the Beloved. He takes this and he plays his melody on it. Because it's clean and open, the melody is perfect. It sounds so beautiful. And of course, the instrument that it's played on feels the effects of this. So we're like instruments in the hands of the divine musician or shepherd. But each of us has a different quality. This back to this theme of the uniqueness of each of us. Each of us is a different instrument. Each of us will produce the melody will be different, will sound different. The melody is the same, but the sound of it as it's produced through us will be unique. It will have a particular singular quality and will be expressive again of that oneness and uniqueness of God that's been reflected in human reality by making each of us distinct. We don't know maybe what that full melody will be, but we keep busy scrubbing out the channel and removing all the things that shouldn't be there, and then the music will play. With both his inner and his outer ear, he will hear from its dust the hymns of glory. Now he's describing this city of God with all of its elements. We've got a tree here, we've got dust, and praise. The hymns of glory and praise ascending unto the Lord of Lords, and with his inner eye will he discover the mysteries of return and revival. Now you recall we were dealing with these subjects earlier on. This is the question of the resurrection of the manifestation, the coming of the return of the manifestation of God to the world, and the effect that it produces, and the return of the qualities of his own qualities and of the qualities of those immediate disciples and of the qualities of those who become the early followers of the faith. In other words, the spirit of life that breathed in the early stages of these previous revelations is revived. Return of the qualities and revival of that spirit. How unspeakably glorious are the signs, the tokens, the revelations and splendors which he who is the king of names and attributes hath destined for that city. The attainment of this city quencheth thirst without water and kindleth the love of God without fire. Within every blade of grass are enshrined the mysteries of an inscrutable wisdom, and upon every rosebush a myriad nightingales pour out in blissful rapture their melody. Its wondrous tulips unfold the mystery of the burning bush, and its sweet savors of holiness breathe the perfume of the messianic spirit. It bestoweth wealth without gold and conferreth immortality without death. In every leaf, ineffable delights are treasured, and within every chamber, unnumbered mysteries lie hidden. In one of his tablets, Abdu'l-Bahá says that within the divine verses, within every verse, within every phrase, every word, every letter, he says, nay, within every point, surge oceans of divine significance and rushing torrents and rivers of holy and glorious meanings. And he said, and I can explain all of these, but alas, there's no ear to hear. Now, as interpreter of the Word of God, he sees this. Now, Baha'u'llah promises us something of that, some touch of that, at another level, a reflected step down, a considerable step down, if you will, from the glory of the manifestation seeing its meanings, from the interpreter seeing its meanings. But we have the writings of the interpreter, which help to open the way for us. And we see fresh meanings in the writings when we approach them and read them, when we pray, when we meditate. We find new significances. And one of the joys of studying together and discussing the teachings with kindred souls is that they will have meanings that will strike us too. We'll understand that those meanings are also correct. And we know he says about 70 and two meanings. This is the question of the different levels of the soul. There's a tablet of Baha'u'llah about Kulli Ta'am, the tablet of all food, the surah of all food from the Quran. He interprets this tablet. And one of the questions there is the meaning of certain words, certain terms in that tablet. And he says that for the dwellers in this world, this word means this. He says, but if you read this in the next stage up, and he describes one of the higher worlds, he says, then the meaning is that. And for the dwellers, the denizens of this heavenly supernal realm, this word has this significance. And if you go to the higher realm, it has this meaning. He shows how the same divine verse will be interpreted in the different levels of spiritual existence. And in this same way, this reflects to us. The soul has infinite degrees of development and growth, and in each stage, Baha'u'llah will open the shells and reveal the pearls of that stage, the appropriate understandings and divine significances that you are going to enjoy as a fruit of reaching that level of understanding and spiritual perception and divine attraction. Baha'u'llah promises, they that valiantly labor in quest of God's will, when once they have renounced all else but Him, the price is painful and expensive, but the reward infinite and all glorious. That once they have renounced all else but Him, will be so attached and wedded to that city that a moment's separation from it would to them be unthinkable. They will hearken unto infallible proofs from the hyacinth of that assembly and receive the surest testimonies from the beauty of its rose and the melody of its nightingale. I understand by these titles, Hyacinth, Rose, and Nightingale, the manifestation of God. You may have your own understandings of it. Once in about 1,000 years shall this city be renewed and re-adorned. There's a letter from Shoghi Effendi written on his behalf in 1938. He says, as to the meaning of the passage in the Agon in which Baha'u'llah refers to the renewal of the city of God once in about 1,000 years, this, as the word about implies, is simply an approximate date and should not therefore be taken literally. In another letter, published in Baha'i News, American Baha'i News number 102, another answer related to this is given. He says, concerning your question relative to the duration of the Baha'i dispensation, there is no contradiction between Baha'u'llah's statement in the Agon about the renewal of the city of God once every 1,000 years and that of the guardian in the dispensation to the effect that the Baha'i cycle will extend over a period of at least 500,000 years. The apparent contradiction is due to the confusion of the term cycle and dispensation. For while the dispensation of Baha'u'llah will last for at least 1,000 years, his cycle will extend still further to at least 500,000 years. The Baha'i cycle is indeed incomparable in its greatness. It includes not only the prophets that will appear after Baha'u'llah, but all those who have preceded him ever since Adam. These should indeed be viewed as constituting but preliminary stages leading gradually to the appearance of this supreme manifestation of God. Now you have to help me. You have some questions, some comments? Please. Well, we know that the physical are symbols of spiritual realities. The whole idea of physical things is that they serve as symbols of spiritual things. So I think that the very grass also can inspire us in a sense. I mean, he says you'll see in everything, even in the atoms of things. It depends the way we look at it. Nature is a potent source of inspiration, for sure. The reports of Abdu'l Baha, you get the feeling of almost communing with fruit trees. He would walk up to a fruit tree and he would look at the tree and it just seemed to be encompassing. This being would just be encompassed by the power of this force that has raised this tree up and spread its branches out and covered it with these gorgeous green leaves and then adorned it with the ornaments of these rich and beautiful fruits. He would touch the fruits. An image. He talks about communing with the meadows and the passages, communing with nature. Oh, we see this reflected in the work of poets and spiritual writers of the past too. Be looking at a scene and suddenly it's transformed. It seems to be aflame with God's spirit and God's presence. An ordinary scene suddenly transformed. But obviously it's still the way it was, except that you've now seen it in a new way. Well, not everyone has these same experiences, but it hints at something that's there, and hints at something that's here, I think, in what the Agon has been telling us.
Meditation,
I think it's the latter. It's my own understanding of it. One might take time for meditation also after prayer, praying and not just, you know, finishing the last word and jumping up and springing back to whatever we wanted to do. Taking a little time at the end of a prayer to sit and ponder on the meanings and whatever message. It's like sending a message, you know. Instead of waiting for the answer, you leave the telephone booth immediately and run outside. And I never get any answer to my prayers, you know. You're sending lots of messages, but you got to listen for the answer, too. Meditation is kind of like listening for the answer, one kind of meditation. And another, I think, is when you go on all day pondering on something. Now, the whole point of fueling up the tank in the morning is so that you have something to ponder on. You know? Well, if you have a wonderful Oriental inheritance and you've memorized the hidden words or something like that, of course, you can choose whichever one you want to meditate on and think about it during the day. But if you haven't, you may have to read something. You need still to read something, or at least recite something. The commandment to recite the verses of God is recite the verses of God morn and eve. It doesn't say read them. It can mean read them, but it's recite them. So that this also includes people who can't read and write. They can't just be left out of spiritual life because they can't read and write or because their language doesn't have a written form, but they can recite these verses. They can learn them and recite them and ponder on their meanings and implications. This must be very important. It's not just for, you know, sometimes we say, well, in the future, you know, in the golden age, people will have time to meditate and think, we've got a lot of work to do. We've got to serve and build assemblies and do this and do that. Shoghi Effendi says, for effective Baha'i service, four things. I keep repeating this, so I'm sure you're tired to hear it, but anyway. Prayer, meditation, what's the third one? Okay. Study and action. Prayer, meditation, study and action. Now those should be in balance. Now think of it. Prayer, meditation, and study, they're inner things that you're doing, you know, thinking, orienting, and preparing yourself so that the action that you take will be effective. But the action itself also prompts more prayer and meditation and study, because now you're going to teach the faith. You decide to talk to somebody about the faith, and you start speaking to them, and they raise some question. They ask you some question of which you know nothing about. You think, my goodness. Now you have two choices. You have the choice of making up a good answer based on divine inspiration or whatever you might have. Or you can say, well, I really don't know the answer to this, but the Baha'i teachings have a vast number of subjects, and it's not possible for anybody to remember it all, but I'll check on that for you. That's a very interesting question. Either way, you're going to want to go back and study and pray and meditate some more so that you'll be better equipped for the next time somebody asks you something of that sort. Now, there's a whole range, as we realize, of fundamental Baha'i verities and teachings which we should strive and endeavor to understand and to place in balance one with the other so that we will give a correct view of the faith when we teach the cause. Vigan is one of the basic sources of these truths, as outlined by Shoghi Effendi in his list of major themes and topics which we discussed early on in the course. And if you don't have a list of that, look in God Passes By and find it and write out the list, because it's a help. You can put it right in your Vigan if you have mind to, a place you can put it in there, or put it on a paper and put it in there. Yes, it's...
My question is, what does it mean when certain times Baha'i? And does it mean that people who are not Baha'i, they can't be God's
Well, there's of course some human development. We're talking, he speaks there of the soul, and he says that the seed of the spirit, it starts growing. It's like a seed. If you put it in proper ground, or if it's exposed to the right conditions, the seed breaks and begins growing. And likewise, this seems to be the spirit of faith that should pervade the soul. In other words, faith is awakened through a proclamation of the cause or teaching the cause to somebody. They listen, and there's some mysterious something happens inside of them that they say, that's right, this is true. This is true what you're saying. This is true what you are. And they're attracted to it. And it's on that spark of faith that one adds more fuel. So you build a fire of faith. So you build a bright light of faith in the individual soul. But as the house has said, this spark of faith can go out if it's unattended. You know? It should be a spark which will burn by itself before it's left alone. It doesn't need to be constantly rekindled. See, there's some the states of some souls can be rekindled, but you've got to be there right doing it steady till it takes a hold, till it dries out the dampness of their receptivity, so to speak, and overcomes the influences of the world that are constantly putting the light out, putting the fire out. And you build on it, breathe on it. It's the process that he says then goes on growing. Then this quality of faith grows in the soul. It develops into a tree, into a plant, into a tree, and finally it gives fruits. And the very effect of your spiritual growth, you bear fruit in the form of being able to teach through your qualities and your spiritual attitudes other souls will be attracted to the reality of your tree, so to speak, and of what that spirit of faith has produced in you. Now, if you have an old tree and dry fruits and they're kind of bitter, probably need some pruning, serious pruning, you know. And you ask God for tests and he prunes this thing back and gets it to me. Maybe he'll graft on some really special things onto it too. Somebody else over here wants to speak.
It's about the issue of deepening, like deepening in the morning. Then we have all day to think and meditate about what we read in the morning. What about at night when we meditate? Then we go to sleep and then we read something in the morning which maybe contains a certain passage. It kind of erases what we read at night.
Well, I've heard often heard two variations on meditation at night. One is the meditation which leads to profound sleep almost immediately. And the other type of person is that they say, I don't dare read very much at night because then I never go to sleep. I get so exhilarated that I'm awake for hours, and then of course you miss the morning meditation that way because you can't wake up enough to think about it in the morning. But you can read the same book. You can continue, take up where you left off if you want some continuity. But I think in itself, the divine truths are such that they can be used. Apart from their meaning, there's two things to the verses. There are the verses and what the words say, and there is the music of them that stirs the soul by its spiritual power and emotion. Now, Baha'u'llah, when he relates about these verses, he says, you know, that don't tire yourself out with excess of reading the verses. He said the point of it is that the soul should take wings, that it should soar on the verses. He says this in the Akta. It should soar on the wings of the divine verses. So if you read them and, you know, you just feel sleepy and nothing's happening, that's not fulfilling really the requirement of that. So one wants to get to the point where a little reflection, also there's a certain attitude, there's a certain posture, spiritual posture when you're going to approach the words that you can take. If you take time and you think, before you start reading even, you know, you stop and you say the greatest name and you turn to Baha'u'llah and say, make this the fulfillment of your law. Help me to penetrate some meaning. In other words, turn up the intensity of your intention and then open and read these verses. and see what they can do. Oftentimes you don't have time to read a lot. What?
What about physical stuff?
Meditate lying down, I think, for that reason of getting sleepy in the evening. I remember I even sometimes have to stand up if I'm going to have to. You get so tired that there's no way, you know, you will get sleepy if you read anything, even for a minute. I was so relieved when I found in a book of sayings by Muhammad, he says, if you're drowsy in your prayers, and he gives the remedy, he says, go to sleep. It's such good sound advice, you know. God doesn't want to listen to your sleepy prayers, but you should better arrange yourself so you can say your obligatory prayers when you've got some life in you to say them. And the same with these verses, to some degree, you know, repeat them. Well, it's true, unless you say the one where you just stand still. But then you're not usually sleepy at that hour. Someone else, please.
You're talking about your you your
Well, it's 6,000 years. As compared to 500,000 years, if you round it out, it pretty much encompasses the 6,000 years. But actually, the date for the 500,000 years, if you're going to count them and be prepared at the end of that for something else, it starts at the time of the appearance of the Bab. According to the foreword of God Passes By, he says that the Baha'i cycle commenced with the appearance of the Bab and his declaration. But in another sense, he's saying here that it encompasses, because if it were not for the appearance of this universal cycle now, these prophets that were the precursors of it wouldn't have appeared. And this is the same meaning, that if it were not for him, no divine messenger would have come to the world. It's saying the same truth, as far as I understand. It's saying that because the prophets that we remember, the messengers that we have some knowledge of, have all come from Adam and after, from Adam's time on. And they've all referred to this great day of God. So this is the connection. Now the prophets for the remaining 500,000 years will come under the shadow of Baha'u'llah, will derive inspiration from the energies that he's released. Now Abdul Baha, in some answered questions, you should read the chapter on universal manifestations there. He also refers to universal cycles, which is a great period of development. He said Adam was the opening of this universal cycle. Baha'u'llah is its universal manifestation. And he speaks of that in terms of 500,000 years. So in a sense, it sounds like a contradiction, but if you take the two together, you see that we have two prophetic cycles, one from Adam up to the Bab, and one from the Bab on to the 500,000 years. That basically there's two universal prophetic cycles within a universal cycle, as described by Abdul Baha. This is at least the way I've understood it. Do you remember the first hidden word? Possess a pure, kindly, and radiant heart, that thine may be a sovereignty, ancient, imperishable, and everlasting. There's something, how I don't know how this time world fits into it, but the first world, ancient, first word, ancient, there means pre-existent. In other words, you become an eternal. When you become eternal, are you just eternal from now on? when you become aware of the world of eternity, do you become aware of a sense of time that begins now and goes on through the rest of eternity? Or do somehow you catch up with what you missed before you came? In other words, does your eternality and your pre-existence then encompass a realm which has no beginning and no end, and which you partake of in its fullness, but which you can't understand here because this is a world of time? Now, there's a tablet of the manifestation called the Tablet of the Manifestation, where Baha'u'llah describes this, how the manifestation appears in all the realms of God. And he says in each realm he will appear invested or in a form suitable to that realm. But what the simultaneity of it is, he doesn't say exactly. No, so. That there's no way to say, you know, because you can't imagine space or not space, but there is such a thing as being in the next world and being deprived of Baha'u'llah's presence. So just the fact that he's there and represents God in those kingdoms, in those realms, as well as here, it doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be in the court of his immediate presence. There are degrees and stages and development of souls and so on. And though time and space is not like it is here, and yet he describes for us the cities of eternity and the oceans of grandeur and all these things, you know, that they will have some meaning. In other words, these symbols will mean something spiritually there. We don't know now what we see sometimes in dreams, something maybe. We don't know how it will be. I remember, please. Those spiritual worlds? I should think they would all be more advanced because they're after this world. I mean, the dwellers of those realms presumably have come through the human experience in some way, in some state. Also, of course, they would have their... They would also partake of those inner worlds, you know. Presumably their unity takes place in these higher spiritual stages between the infinite range of beings that exist in the universe. Who knows how that works? What work the prophets have in the other realms in relating souls to each other. I remember this is just a footnote, so to speak, but there was a lady in Oregon who had been teaching another woman, and this lady died before she became a Baha'i. So she was worried about her, you know, because she'd been starting to teach her and she hadn't accepted, and she was, well, what state would her soul be in? And she was praying about her and so sorry that she hadn't accepted the faith before she died. And after some weeks she had a dream, and this lady came to her all dressed radiantly in light and told her to stop worrying, not to worry. She says, I'm fine, I'm so happy, I'm in the most wonderful place. And she says they had a special day of some sort. They had a holy day, she said. And then on such an occasion, Baha'u'llah appeared for a time on the horizon and shone light in our whole world where we were. And then she seemed to imply that on certain special days he would make an appearance like that, and they would see him. She's recognized him, she's fine, she's happy, but she hadn't been serving here their whole life, but she's training there, so to speak. I think, you know, there's a question of the education, spiritual education of souls in the other world. This is affirmed in letters. Shoghi Effendi has said that a soul that dies without having, even one in profound spiritual darkness, can through repentance, through praying to God, through the prayers of others, gradually become illumined, transformed, and spiritually educated. So there must be a process of training and education there. Surely there must be, when you think of how many souls come into being here and are lost in utero. You know, they never born. They're lost. They're conceived but lost, not because of anything we do, but just that happens. Somehow, I should think that the number of souls that are not born are quite more numerous than the ones that are born. And then you have infantile mortality, which finishes off so many more of them. We're kind of probably the odd cases, you know, the leftover that get stuck in this world, so to speak, and go through everything that has to happen here. Maybe it's special, I'm sure there's special wisdoms in it and all. But there must be provision for all those children of the kingdom who go immediately stainless to the other worlds and then become and develop. And Abdu'l-Bahá says, you will meet your sons and daughters fully grown and in spiritual maturity in the next world. And you'll recognize them. You're not going to not know who they are. They will know who you are.
What about those people who are just live a life that's cool? I mean, God here, and it's like God doesn't even enter their life. And they die, and they've done nothing, and nothing happens to them. What about them? Do they go through the same thing as each other? Unborn babies?
Well, nobody knows what happens to souls on the other side, but the indications are that they will have to go through a period of remorse and sadness and cleansing. Eventually, nobody is condemned to darkness forever. That, at least we know that. It's not an eternal state. Like the Christians used to talk about eternal damnation. That was it. You know, you went to hell and you stayed there forever, finished. Michael. Yes. That's because the soul is pure and undefiled at creation, but then it begins acquiring experiences. And at first, of course, it's operating on its animal instincts, you know? So it acquires the darkness of the animal unless it's constantly prayed for and dealt with. And even then, I think it has to go through a period of growth and change and struggle, these stages of growth that children have. Then it needs to acquire that, it needs to go back to that purity through its own efforts. In other words, it cleanses the mirror back to that original undefiled state. Let me see here. There's indications that they become aware immediately of what, you know, either the remorse of their having missed the reality, or they have a chance. There's some letters which says they have a chance to embrace the light if they've never heard of it or never been exposed to it. Then they have a chance to embrace it there. And otherwise, the soul has to be prepared in some way to acquire attraction. You know, to know what process it goes through. We're assisted to move forward spiritually here through grave spiritual tests. You know, we're sent tests and suffering. It says specifically, he sends us sadness and suffering so that we can break loose from our superficiality and from our illusion that happiness is good times and I don't know what all the things that we think are happiness, you know. And he plows the soul. He says he plows the soul through tests so that the seeds of the spirit can go deep into our beings and produce a rich harvest. But if God just throws the seeds on the surface and we're a very hard soil, maybe one or two little seeds take a hold and most of it's lost. So he has to give us something. Give us hell here, so to speak. Give us problems, give us difficulties to awaken us. Now, as soon as we grow beyond those stages, then those very tests become, as we were talking about, stepping stones, you know, like rocks that you keep tripping over. Eventually you find out how to walk on the top of them, and then you cross the rushing river without drowning yourself every time by falling into it. Or he gives you wings, which gradually you learn to fly with and stay off the ground, so to speak.
What about the future manifestation of God? Do we know about them after we die? Or?
Do we know about them before they come, you mean?
Yeah.
I don't know, that's a good question. First time I ever heard that. First time I ever heard that. I don't know, I never saw an answer to that. I remember there's a tablet of the Bab in which he says, which I think I've mentioned to you. You have to take this as a footnote because it's not published. I mean as a pilgrim note because it's not published. But he said that ere the hour he chose to appear within his mother's womb, he went to visit Muhammad. And they discussed there together the fate of the Shia priests, the ulama, what should happen to them in the Bab's dispensation. They decided, he said, three stages. Set it forth, and the Bab reveals this in a tablet to the priests. You know, and he talks about their time that they will be raised up and seem to be supreme and everything, he says, and then they will be cast down. God will first give them great prestige, raise them up, make them feel that they've really done it, you know, and then he will dash their hopes forever and destroy their influence for what they have wrought. Already, even before the Bab's coming, because they made a mess of Islam before the Bab's coming. You know? And then after, I mean, they just added the crown of all of their wicked doings on top of it. Now, how is that? Shall we see him before he came here? I don't know if we were there. We can't answer these things, but they're interesting to ponder on. The point of all of that, I think, is that the prophets of God are a reality, a distinguishable reality, one from the other, and we are all realities distinguishable one from the other in another world. We do not suddenly, as a drop, go back to the ocean and disappear and become part of the great universal spirit. We have a form suitable to us. We will have more intense identification and reality, individual reality, than ever we have had here. You know, we keep thinking that we imagine the other world and we say, well, gosh, without a body, you know, I won't be what I am now and probably be less. And who will see me? You know, will I be thin? Will I be fat? Will I be this? You don't know any of these things. You know? But the reality of the soul is going to be something there that will be the best of all forms for that world, just as this is the best of all forms for this world. Now we can trust to it that it will be all right.
Is it possible that the soul that is carefully read through this world or in this world can go through without necessarily being affected by the negative influence of society?
That is how read, carefully read, that's carefully,
carefully
reared.
Yeah.
Ah. I think that it can have a great deal of protection from it. The negative influences of society we should distinguish from the God-sent tests. Because the God-sent test, he says, my calamity is my providence. Outwardly it's fire and vengeance. Inwardly it's light and mercy. That's something else. But the things that we foolishly indulge ourselves in that become the source of, or become, that affect us because they're the dark things of life, then we're responsible for it. So there's two kinds of tests. One we bring on ourselves and one that comes from God. Now the soul that's properly reared will still have tests from God because he has promised to do that. I mean, that's a blessing from him that enables us to move forward. And he's invented the world in that way. Is anybody going to ever be able to live here that doesn't witness the death of their grandmother or their mother or some relative that's close to them, or all of their relatives? Or, all of the fires have turned into fountains. All of the thorns have turned into roses. It's nice. No, I think there's those two possibilities. You know, well, one, God says it's it's just not possible. He says he won't test you beyond your capacity, and your capacity is just so little that he can't take a chance on you. I don't mean this personally, of course. Or that, what's the other choice? Or that you've overcome certain tests. Certain things are not tests for you. Because you have a certain integrity of spirit, a certain level of obedience and clinging to the law of God, the Word of God, and it protects you. You may have temptations, but you don't have tests in that same sense, you know. At least on those things. But then God will find it, He'll find His time to give you a test on something that you didn't even realize that was a problem. You know? I don't know, it depends. But it's nice if you say your prayers and you don't feel like you have tests.
No.
Well, I don't know. We could take a survey. Is there anybody in the room who hasn't felt that they've been tested? And if there is anybody, we can offer them this section in the prayer book on tests and difficulties. Please, Mark. Catherine's like. You can take another example. You can say that you're seeking spiritual nourishment. You know, you will grow and develop and grow strong if you eat the proper food. And the proper food is the divine food of the verses of God and their spiritual meaning. So in order to grow, you have to eat. In order to eat, you have to feed yourself. You know? In other words, there's some action that has to be taken by the individual to achieve the purpose. So God plows the field, the seeds of the Spirit. He says, plant the seeds of the Spirit. My understanding of that is to read the verses of God and ponder on their meaning so that they will act in the ground of your being, you know. They will be there. You will be thinking about them. The ancient philosophers have said that you will become whatever you think about. And you know, it has a meaning. It has a significance. It still holds. Whatever you're thinking about, that's the thing you're focused on, you center on. Now examine your thoughts. What is it you think about? Remember we had this test a few weeks ago? Listen to yourself for 24 hours what you're talking about. This is worse yet. Listen to what you're thinking about. What is it that's on your mind all the time? Take 24 hours and keep watching. It's a very disturbing process. Please, Catherine, sorry, bypassed you earlier. Now, look, this is what I call the Baha'i fables, I categorize these things. You know, one of the problems that where this comes from is a passage in the Gleanings where it says that if the soul is deprived of its consciousness, its personality, its everything at death, then how can it have any reality, you know? if it just gets knocked on the head here and it loses consciousness? What will happen if there it's deprived of all these things? And Baha'u'llah doesn't answer that directly. He states what the soul is and how it will be and what it will do. We don't lose our personalities when we go to the next world. And as far as it's concerned, maybe we don't lose our gender. We don't have sex as such. But maybe we retain, for identification purposes, with each other in the early stages anyway. You know, we don't all turn into neuters. We actually... He talks about maids of heaven and maidservants and servants and so on. We don't know. We can't imagine, you know. But when you have dreams, you see souls that have passed on in terms of female vestments and male attire. I mean, there's the difference. You still see the difference, so to speak, of the persons. I don't know how that works, you know? Or whether that's just to assist us to recognize them while we're still in this world and we see them. Whether those dreams are even true, I don't know. That's another thing. Depends on the kinds of dreams. But I mean, people that see Abdu'l Baha see him with a beard still. So what? It's hard to know what that means. Just that there's no giving and taking in marriage in the next world was that it isn't needed in the sense of to procreate children and so on. But the spiritual closeness, the intimacy that God is destined for the souls to enjoy there is something beyond what we can imagine here, you know. Again, we shouldn't think in any way that that world is less in its enjoyments, in its pleasures, in its spiritual passion and everything than this world. Why should it be less? Since this world is a world of darkness, that world is a world of light. This is a world of deprivation, that's the world of reward. How can we imagine it's less? You know? And yet we do imagine it's less because we can't imagine it. And he said, if we could imagine it, we wouldn't stay here. We would take our lives. We would just not tolerate to be here if we could taste of that. I heard one of the friends was saying here that the guardian, they'd mentioned, what about suicide? You know, what's suicide? And at the pilgrim table, he said, suicide is like arriving at a banquet uninvited. It's a wonderful thing, isn't it? You know, you all have the feeling. Imagine you arrive there, everybody's about to sit down for this gorgeous banquet, and there's one chair short for you, and there's no chair. You know. Oh, you're here. Well. Oh, my goodness. That's the lighter side of it. There's a tablet from Abdu'l Baha which says it's murder. Suicide is murder. Your soul doesn't belong to you to take its life, to take this life of the body. It's just a creature that's been created by God. It happens to be you. What right do you have to kill it? And it's a good thing to tell people who are, you know, tend to be morose and suicidal and things. It's good starch. The master says you'll be charged with murder in the next world. You will be in the condition of someone who's taken a human life that didn't belong to him to take. It's a good tonic. No solution at all. If we can swallow that, then the temptation of that never comes. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
I wonder, since we don't have those nice hardcover versions of the Kitab Yekan in the next world, how are we going to have accept the holy writings? Is there anything you can say about that? Oh, yeah.
I fall back on my old statement. There's nothing less there than there is here. You can be sure you'll have access to the revelation of God. Whatever form it'll be there. Mr. Olinga told me one time he had this dream when he was first pioneering that he would fall asleep and these lovely beings dressed in white robes would come and wake him up and take him into an elevator of light, and they would go into a realm on high and enter a pavilion there, of like an amphitheater, in the center of which was this marvelous glowing light. And he said the people were all sitting around, and from it they would learn the wisdom of all things. And he was allowed to stand in the back and perceive some of it. He told me this dream, my goodness. He didn't have books to read, but he there was something else that gave him the, well, I don't know what the meaning of this is, you know, who knows, but it's very suggestive of what must the next realm be like, what must the association of the souls there be like, what must the presence of the manifestation be like. If I recall correctly, you should check some answered questions about this, but the death of innocent people who die in war or children that are killed and things like that, they're recompensed in the next world. And otherwise there's many laws connected with this, how, in which way they will be recompensed. They won't suffer any loss because of this, having died accidentally or something of that sort. That's the realm of provision for everything. No, I don't think we need to worry about it. Imagine martyrs going. Says, you want to die on your bed? Or do you want to die on the martyr's field? I mean, you have a choice, you know. You want to get old and die of some bad aches and pains or some heart attack that takes you away? Or do you want to go and have the enemy take your whole life so that your whole being is given for the cause of one time? What kind of choice is it? When you really think about it, you know, we're all going to die anyway. If we could die somehow, if we could be privileged to be chosen to be martyred. It's a mysterious thing. The believers in Baha'u'llah's time, they used to write and ask, can I be a martyr? I want to be a martyr. Will you give me martyrdom? Will you allow me to be a martyr? And Baha'u'llah would answer back a variety of ways. Your offering has been accepted. Then he knew, okay, time's coming. He's going to be martyred. Or he'd say that the will of God is that you should live a long life to serve the cause and teach the faith. In that case, he was full of courage. He said, ah, they can't get me now. I can go and teach, you see. What's this? You think martyrdom is because it happens that you're there and the enemies come after you and they kill you and that's it and God has pity on you afterwards or something? You're not going to let any old person become a martyr. This is a high station. I don't believe the people that don't want to be martyred are martyred. I think something happens to them before they are able to have this bounty. You know, they have to have resigned themselves to the will of God. I don't know, maybe it's not the case in every... It seems to me, it feels that way. And the stories that you hear in Persia of the martyrs and the way they were kissed the hands of the executioners and Counselor Farhangi giving them candy, you know. The guys that are going to shoot him are weeping, saying, we don't want to do this, we don't want to do this. He's saying, no, this is your job. You have to obey. I have my part to play. You have your part to play. He's consoling them because they don't want to shoot him. What kind of situation is this? And the families would visit their relatives. And they always say the last visit, you know, that they would make, somehow that their relatives knew that this was the last visit. They would rejoice. They would be so happy. They're going to see the beloved. And they would write these stirring, you've seen these letters that they've written. In the last hour they give them to write their wills or something. And they write these stirring calls to their wife and their children to uphold the standards of the faith and not to worry about them and to do everything for the cause. And nothing about I'm sorry that they're killing me and I know this is bad for you all. And it has a different feeling about it. You know? I hear there was a man that on the way to the execution, one of the Baha'is, he just got in his head, he said, you know, I don't think I want to do this. It was too late, really. They were walking him out into the courtyard in Iran to kill him. And it was a season when it was dry. And it was, he said, we got in the courtyard. I said, Baha'u'llah, do I really need to do this? He said, the sky turned to water. It rained and rained. The rain came down. And the guards said, whoa, what's this rain? And they all ran inside. He was left out in the courtyard. He looked for, he saw a hole in the wall. He went and jumped through the hole in the wall. He was in another room of some abandoned old room and jumped out of a window, ran across a field. It was still raining. Got into a car that picked him up on the road. He hailed down, went away. He's living in New York. I don't know all the details, but this story has a sound of that kind of thing that can happen. You know, you say to yourself, you don't want to be, and I've heard others of this sort. The people said, I don't think I'm ready for this. Okay, all right. Won't happen. It's a curious thing. Maybe that makes you feel good, you know? You shouldn't be afraid of martyrdom in that sense. This is hard to answer. It's the truth of it is for you. He hasn't given visions to somebody else to convince us, you know. Although we feel the influence sometimes when they tell us, you feel this is something true they've experienced. But you're not going to base your life on it. You're not going to follow what he says in place of what it says in the book. But it's a supplement. It's a kind of other thing, you know. And many people who aren't Baha'is also have these near-death experiences, you know, where they've been dead in an accident or near dead and have seen things or have come out apparently out of their bodies and been able to witness events and describe them afterwards, that there was no way they say they could know that because they were covered up. Their body was covered up or something of the sort. But there's many mysterious things related to the process of death or illness. The people that describe relatives, you know, they're non-Baha'i stories. I'm sure you've seen some of them. Read some of them. Somebody's in an old lady's in a deathbed, and the children are there with her, and her husband has died, or her brother has died a couple of days before, and her husband has died some years before, and she's just dying, and she's telling the children she's seeing the other world. It's so beautiful. Oh, and then she welcomes her husband. She sees him, and then she says, "Harry, what are you doing here?" The brother she sees with the husband. Now, they haven't told the lady that the brother's died, but these kind of things, you know, you hear stories like this sometimes. I mean, it's obviously there's connections and mysterious things that we don't know. That world is the real world. This is the counterfeit, so to speak. This is the shadowy realm that looks so solid and is not so solid. Somebody else has something? Well, we've come to the end here, but there's one more paragraph I'd like to read for us to finish this section, then we'll go on with the example and meanings of the Quran afterwards. "Wherefore, O my friend, it behooveth us to exert the highest endeavor to attain unto that city, and by the grace of God and his loving kindness rend asunder the veils of glory, so that with inflexible steadfastness we may sacrifice our drooping souls in the path of the new beloved. We should with tearful eyes fervently and repeatedly implore him to grant us the favor of that grace." Now you remember Baha'u'llah is addressing a non-believer at this stage. He's addressing the uncle of the Bab, who has not yet embraced the revelation of the Bab. "That city is none other than the Word of God revealed in every age and dispensation. In the days of Moses, it was the Pentateuch, in the days of Jesus, the Gospel, in the days of Muhammad, the Messenger of God, the Quran, in this day, the Bayan, and in the dispensation of Him whom God will make manifest, His own book, the book unto which all the books of former dispensations must needs be referred, the book which standeth amongst them all transcendent and supreme. Interesting. Now, here Baha'u'llah is alluding to a book that doesn't exist yet. It's his own Kitab-i Aqdas. Shoghi Effendi quotes this verse from the Iqan here, revealed around 1863, and then the Aqdas revealed about 10 years later. When he's writing God Passes By, he says this verses refer where Baha'u'llah himself makes mention to this book and repeats this statement, the book under which all the books of former dispensations must needs be referred. And it's transcendent and supreme amongst all of them. In these cities, spiritual sustenance is bountifully provided and incorruptible delights have been ordained. The food they bestow is the bread of heaven, and the spirit they impart is God's imperishable blessing. Upon detached souls, they bestow the gift of unity, enrich the destitute, and offer the cup of knowledge unto them who wander in the wilderness of ignorance. All the guidance, the blessings, the learning, the understanding, the faith and certitude conferred upon all that is in heaven and on earth are hidden and treasured within these cities. So as the source of all good unto us is this city of revelation, the divine books that the messengers of God have left. Where next week we'll be taking up the following section, which deals with the Quran in part and is intended to be a proof, if you read ahead, a proof of the fact that there's nothing greater than the divinely revealed verses as a proof of the manifestations of God and as a proof for recognizing subsequent messengers of God. And in part this is a way to get around a number of hadiths which the uncle of the Bab has raised, which were fallacious and not true, and which were acting as veils, keeping the people back from recognizing the Bab. Now, if the verses of the book indicate that the Bab is correct, isn't that enough? Do we have to put the proof of all these sayings and traditional things as well? You see? Even though some of those also prove him to be true. All right, we'll come to that next week.